From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 7th day of December. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, coming to you from Taylorville, Illinois today. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzlo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. And Eric Snodgrass will join us to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast. Along the way, we'll visit with some of the volunteers and the agencies that are here in Taylorville, at something called the MARC. That's the Multi-Agency Resource Center that was set up today to service the folks who suffered through last weekend's tornadoes. And we'll do all of that right here on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Find us online at WILLAG.org. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this Friday afternoon. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason, coming to you from Taylorville today, where they're still in the midst of disaster recovery. We'll hear more about that in just a few moments. We're now joined by Mike Zuzlo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. Hey, good afternoon to you, Mike. Thanks for being with us as we're talking over the noon hour today, because I'm recording early. The market's up maybe, 6 cents or so in the soybeans and a couple in the corn. Why is that the case?
Well, I think primarily, Todd, we had enough export sales business in the corn, in the beans, and in the wheat, and we had enough weakness in the dollar that the trade felt comfortable enough to go ahead and put some premium in the soybeans and head up towards the top end of the range and up towards the weekly highs. Also, those weekly highs in lead month beans are close to 6 month highs as well. So that 923 area, 924 area from Monday after the G20 meeting, you know, we're trying to get back closer to that with a 918 high so far in the session. I think, simply put, they feel like there's a little bit better likelihood that the Chinese and the United States are going to come to some kind of an agreement, and some hard data is going to come eventually. The question mark is, will it come fast enough to actually do some good for the demand? But that's kind of how they, I think, are looking at the market going into the end of the week. Let's put premium in with the idea that we can always take it out, especially with the USDA report right around the corner on Tuesday.
So it's really about the gap time, at least at this point, the time between now and when Brazil is able to fill the needs of China that we're talking about.
Yeah, it really is. And there's only about, I think, a 5 or 6% difference between Brazilian beans at their Gulf or their port and our Gulf of Mexico beans as well. So that, you know, 25% difference that covered the full tariff when that tariff went into place has really shrunk. And that really has been led by as much the Brazilian beans coming down as it has been the U.S. beans going up. So we have done the market's done a phenomenal job in trying to bring that arbitrage back together with this trade truce.
Anything else in the grains that you want to talk about? Because you joined us yesterday on our Commodity Week program. Folks will be able to hear that in just a bit. So I want to make sure you get a chance to do that, but maybe to talk about the macroeconomics as well, what the outside market might mean to you as we move forward.
Yeah, the main focus for me going into Tuesday's report, sticking with the grains and oilseeds, is for the USDA to give us some better supply numbers. In other words, those bushels left out in the field in a lot of different states, and quite a high percentage in some cases, upwards of 20% soybeans left by some of my clients on, say, for instance, the Illinois the Indiana-Ohio border. I would love to see the USDA not lower exports and actually bring the harvested acres or the yield down so that we can take some pressure off of this soybean demand issue with Brazil and with China. The only other thing I would say is that after that USDA report comes out, we have to be ready for some kind of news that could really move the markets, move the producers into selling soybeans. If that second 80 cents comes out from the USDA, I think that'll really trigger a lot of sales. And we covered that pretty in depth on the Commodity Week. I think it's worth listening.
How did the outside markets finish up the week, or at least are they finishing up at this point? I know the OPEC meeting was yesterday, continued through today, and they're ahead of time, so they should have wrapped that up. And then, of course, the Dow, the S&P 500 kind of had a tough week to begin with.
Yeah, you know, this is an interesting dynamic because I think from a commodity front, Todd, you actually are wrapping up the week with quite a bit of tailwind. You had the unemployment or jobs data come out, kind of disappointing. You had the trade deficit at a 10-year high yesterday on Thursday. And so the dollar should be going lower, especially given that, as you referenced, the OPEC nations, not only Saudi Arabia and Russia decided to cut, but there's word that Iran is going to cut as well. And it's going to be about 1.2 million barrels a day for production cut from those three countries. That, too, should be dollar negative or dollar weak. And so I think you've got several key elements going into the weekend and going into next week's USDA report, showing the macro side with the tailwind. The only caveat to that is the equity market. As we're down, you know, nearly 350 points in the Dow futures and almost 40 points in the S&P. That's the market that's not really buying into this Trump trade truce, nor is the hogs. And so you've got the hogs and the equities kind of pulling on the meal. So it's still a bit of a tug of war, but overall, the macro side looks pretty decent.
Is it very concerning to you that the pork complex isn't buying into this, given what, given African swine fever in China, and maybe what it might need for its people to feed them over the next several months?
Yeah, I think it's an excellent leading indicator because China was once again for a second week in a row in for pork, U.S. pork on the export sales report on Friday morning. They were the number four buyer. You've got a situation here where I think it's highly likely they're going to buy an increasing amount. And keep in mind, Todd, the amount they're buying right now, that's at a 62 to 70% tariff. So they're paying big money. If they didn't have a tariff in place, they may be our number one buyer at this point. So yeah, the futures market just doesn't buy the idea that we're going to get the hogs. And I looked at the hogs for the week, even with the tariff agreement and the truce from the G20 meeting, we're down 6% in the hogs for the week. So either they built a lot of premium in or they just don't buy it or a combination of the two. That's going to be, though, a major feature to the next couple weeks trade for me and how I look at the ag sector as a whole.
Yeah, so those two things don't exactly go together, meaning that they're actually in buying, but the complex itself says, we don't care that you're buying. We're not convinced the truce is going to take place.
No, that's a huge point because look at the soybeans. We're waiting with the idea, oh, the beans will go up another leg once we get the hard news. Well, the hogs already have it and they've shed 6%. So that's the dynamic right now that, you know, this is what the loss of multilateralism and global trade does to a market. It makes it very, very hard, even harder than before, to anticipate. Even with the algorithmic trader, it makes it much, much harder to anticipate.
That's Mike Zuzulo. He's with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. Hey, do visit the Farm Doc Daily website, because this is one of the last days that you can sign up ahead of time, pre-register, for the Illinois Farm Economic Summits. The agricultural economist, ag policy specialist from the U of I, and I will be on the road the week of the 17th of December in DeKalb, Peoria, Springfield, Champaign, and Mount Vernon. You can sign up today. Do that at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu for the Illinois Farm Economics Summits. Well, earlier this morning, I visited Taylorville at the MARC, which stands for something pretty unique, and Gail Lundeen is here. She's with Red Cross, and she's the community lead. You're putting this together. Tell me what a MARC is and what that means to a community after a disaster like, you know, the tornado that Taylorville suffered through on Saturday evening.
Okay. A MARC is a multi-agency resource center. It's sort of a one-stop shop for the services that people impacted by a disaster needs. So at one time, a person would have to go to a contractor. They would have to go to the insurance office. They would have to go here. They'd have to go there. What we do is we gather all the agencies together in one spot that might provide them services, and they go around, talk to one person at one time so they can get it done efficiently, so they can get back to their lives of trying to put everything back together again.
You're not from Taylorville. How often have you been deployed, and is this what you do as a volunteer for Red Cross?
I am a volunteer with the Red Cross, and in Blue Sky, which means there's nothing going on, I am the training lead for this region of the Red Cross. We cover 78 counties, 2 in Iowa, 4 in Missouri, and the rest are in Illinois. I do go to deployments. I do various other things. I do like to do marks because it's just very heartwarming to bring the clients together with the partner agencies and make that happen. The other things I've done, disaster assessment. I've responded to tornadoes, floods, etc. It's something I do in my retirement. I volunteer.
What do you expect people will find around the room today? And this is a room full of agencies. How much help will they actually be able to get?
There are some agencies here that are actually providing financial resources to them. Team Rubicon is here, will help them cut down trees, things, as will the Southern Baptists, so they can seek services. They will have to go through a screening process, which we will see that they were impacted by the tornadoes, and then they will be eligible to come in and talk to the various agencies.
That's Gail Lundeen of the American Red Cross. She's organizing the MARC today in Taylorville, Illinois. That's the Multi-Agency Resource Center. Here are some of the folks that are represented as volunteers.
My name is Kendall Bruton, and I'm with Team Rubicon, and I'm the Midwest Disaster Operations Associate. Team Rubicon is a veteran-based disaster relief organization that specializes in rapid response to communities after disaster. We provide damage assessments as well as debris removal, chainsaw operations, heavy equipment operation, and spontaneous volunteer management.
My name is Mark Quiet. I'm a case manager with St. Vincent de Paul, and we are here primarily to give out gift cards to those who need them, and as well, we also offer long-term recovery assistance with case management, and we have a program that's called House in a Box, which basically that's what it is. We provide bedding, sofas, tables come with it, a host of things that people would lose in their house, and they might be underinsured or no insurance, but that usually comes at a later date, but that's what we offer.
My name is Dwayne Doyle with Southern Baptist Disaster Relief, and during a disaster like this, we're providing chainsaw relief for getting trees removed off of homes. We do debris removal and anything that we can help a family, if it's even cleaning out a house, if a tree has fallen in a house. We're going to help any way we can. We usually come and we stay until the end of the event is officially deemed it's finished. During this MARC, we've got child care that's provided so homeowners can come and focus on meeting with agencies and their children are taken care of if they're here. We have trained disaster assessors that come in and help us see, is this a job that we can do? And there's very few that we meet that we don't try and serve the homeowner in some way.
Pam Moses, Taylorville Food Pantry. We're just restocking from people losing their homes or power or their pantry, whatever they need, refrigerated food as well as freezer and pantry.
I'm Janice, and we're with Montgomery County Health Department, but we actually provide elder services also in Christian County. We're just offering information about our in-home services for seniors and providing information to them regarding the senior center here in town or any other services they might need for people that are 60 and over.
Gary Rexroad, Christian County Sheriff's Office. We're providing emergency relief funds. We've been providing it all week. We're just out here with a little bit of funds we have left. And then we have a generous donation that we're taking applications for to see who we can help in the future with more funds.
So when you say you're providing funds, does that mean gift cards? What kinds of things are you providing?
Yes, gift cards to Walmart is what was purchased, so they could purchase anything, medicine, food, clothing, anything that they need from Walmart.
My name is Ashley Bell, and I'm with the University of Illinois Extension. And so we are providing research-based educational material today focused on disaster recovery. So we have information on family financial planning after a disaster, as well as food, safety, and nutrition when the power goes out, and how to care for your trees during a disaster.
Ashley Earls, Midwest Mission Distribution Center, and today here, because we help with humanitarian relief, we have our cleaning kit, our hygiene kit, and our school kit. In addition to that, we also have over 1,000 empty totes. So families, as they're trying to recover and put their personal items in a safe place, they'll have that, these totes that we have here today.
So tell me about the cleaning kit. What does it contain? And maybe a little bit about the hygiene and school supply kits,
too. Yeah, definitely. So inside our cleaning kit is going to be everything that the family's going to need to help recovering, trying to clean up their home. It's got cleaning supplies, garbage bags in it, some dust masks, some different variety of gloves for them, a waterproof glove, a heavy-duty-er glove, and then items to help kind of sanitize. Then in our hygiene kit is just the bare necessities that they would need if they've lost everything. And then our student kit is for any kiddos that, again, lost everything they needed. So from your pencils to crayons to scissors and notebooks.
So that's just a small snippet of the MARC, the Multi-Agency Resource Center. It represents one of the first steps in the process of recovery for the community of Taylorville, all communities, in fact, that suffer through a disaster. In this case, in one organized place, Red Cross put all of that together. The next step is to find out whether the community actually qualifies for some emergency financial help. That comes through the state and federal governments. I asked Jennifer Ricker earlier in the day about the process. She is the deputy director of the Illinois Emergency Management Agency.
So there's a few different programs that may be made available from the federal government. One would be for individual assistance, and it is a grant program. There's a public assistance program that the federal government also has, and that is for local governments, essentially state and local government. And then there's usually the Small Business Administration, which is a low-interest loan program. So those three programs are the main ones that when people think of federal assistance, those are the three.
So as with all government agencies and funded programs, there usually are a set of qualifications that must be met. What's that process like, and what are the qualifications in this case?
Correct. So very generally, the way the federal government looks at this, what FEMA will do is determine whether or not, if we get to that point of asking them for federal aid, they look at it whether or not it's beyond the states and the state and local capabilities to deal with the event and recover from the event. So in the case of public assistance specifically, which is for local governments and state government costs, so public costs. The state itself has a threshold of $19.2 million approximately to hit. And then the county, each county also has their own number that they have to hit on top of that. And for the case of Christian County here, it's approximately $131,000. So sometimes that can be a very difficult, very high threshold for the state to hit. For individual assistance, there's no specific threshold. They have kind of some ballpark. We usually have an idea based on the size of the state and what we've seen in previous disasters for the number of homes and businesses that have to be damaged or destroyed, like really severely, majorly damaged or destroyed. And that's hundreds and hundreds of homes in that category. So even though we may have hundreds of homes here, if they're not in those categories, it also may not rise to that level. And then they also look at the level of insurance and a few other factors as well.
So just to clarify, to get to that point, the $19.2 million, mm-hmm. roughly speaking, that's $19.2 million of uninsured or uninsured properties totaled. So once you add up all of the damage that's done, you're looking to see what's left that's not covered by insurance.
So the $19.2 million is actually for government costs, so that's separate from individuals. So that's often a point of confusion. So that's really like, and it's not just damage itself, that's also emergency response costs, things like that. So there's different categories and qualifications even within that public assistance program. But for individual assistance, which is homeowners and businesses and things like that, again, it's not so much a dollar threshold, but they're looking at the totality of the magnitude of it. And typically for a state our size, they're going to look for hundreds and hundreds of homes that are majorly damaged or destroyed.
How long will it take to do the assessment for Taylorville, do you think?
So the county and the city itself, they're underway. They're close to finishing that up. we'll look at that and review that with them to determine whether or not we think it warrants asking the federal government to actually come in and do what's called a preliminary damage assessment, a joint preliminary damage assessment with them. So we're getting closer, but we're still a ways away from determining whether or not there might be any federal assistance that would be available. And then public assistance, we're even farther still. They're just beginning to collect those costs.
It's Jennifer Ricker. She is the deputy director of the Illinois Emergency Management Agency. I talked to her earlier in the day here at the MARC. That's the multi-agency resource center that has been put together in Taylorville, Illinois, to service the victims of last weekend's tornadoes. When we come back, speaking of weather, we'll talk with Eric Snodgrass from Agrible. You're listening to the Closing Market Report on this Friday afternoon. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason at the MARC, or Multi-Agency Resource Service, in Taylorville, Illinois. And we're now joined by Eric Snodgrass from Agrible. Eric is in Effingham today. I guess we're both traveling. Eric, thanks for taking the time to be with us. Let's start with maybe a quick recap of what happened here in Taylorville and what that weather system was like.
Yeah, that system last weekend was pretty impressive. It looked more like a big springtime, big low pressure system. And we basically, in the middle of the day on Saturday, got a little bit of what we call the dry sock that came into Western Illinois, and it allowed for the atmosphere to be stabilized. And when the storms finally did erupt, you know, I would have imagined, my forecast, by the way, would have suggested that those storms would have kind of not been discrete cells, but would have been more of like a line of storms. But given the wind shear profile, the storm started spinning, and they were able to maintain that that characteristic. And so we had well over 20 reports of tornadoes. And where you are was probably the hardest place in the state. They measured the wind tornado at 155 miles an hour, so it was bad.
Speaking of storms, there is one south of us at this point. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so this one's going to stay to our south too. Basically, that we have high pressure dominating us right now, and as a consequence, the low pressure is going to skirt around to its south. So we got some issues in Texas, parts of Oklahoma, and over toward Arkansas with some snow. Very, very heavy rain south of there, and that's going to move all the way over toward North Carolina, Virginia in the coming days here. And so they're actually going to get hammered in the mountains there, in the Appalachian Mountains, maybe well over a foot of snow in some places extending into Virginia, and then, of course, western two-thirds of North Carolina. So we've got a big one going to our south, but really around here, we're looking at probably 5 days, next 5 days, having pretty low chances of having precipitation, relatively quiet pattern. And we're slowly going to start to see our temperatures ease back toward more normal type temperatures for this part of December. I am watching a system around the 14th, the 13th, 14th, 15th. We all need to be paying attention to this because we've got a little shortwave coming through the trough that'll be here about that time period. And it looks as though if it might form in right along the Mississippi River and then take off to the northeast. That could put us back into a pretty stormy pattern, but more this time for heavy rains on the backside.
It's been cold. Will that stick with us?
Well, the good news is there is a bit of kind of relaxing in the overall flow pattern in the atmosphere. And what I mean by that is we've seen this elongation of the polar vortex. It's kind of stretched from Siberia over the North Pole, and then it kind of came down to the eastern half of North America. Well, we're seeing that shift a bit. We're going to be developing a trough over Alaska, and that's going to allow the position of the polar vortex and subsequently the jet stream to kind of get us into a position where we are not going to be seeing such anomalously cold weather. Some of the data just came out. We had a top 10 coldest November on record here in Illinois, and I'm not seeing that continuing through the rest of the month. Now, I'm not saying it's going to be a heat wave, not even close, but it's going to relax a little bit, and that's going to take us more towards reasonable temperatures. So we at least have that to look forward to as we get into the second and third weeks of the month.
What's the long-range forecast look like for the United States?
Yeah, we did get an update from one of the best global models called the European model, and it kind of got a good outlook, and it aligns well with some of the stuff we're seeing with our analog forecast. And basically, if you think about the U.S., just if you start from the central part of the United States and work your way east, so Mississippi River east, we've got risks for the rest of winter that look to be on the near average to cooler than average side. Whereas the Western United States, and especially the Northern U.S., will likely be seeing some near average to warmer than average conditions. So the country looks to be split from the west to the east, west being a little bit warmer than average, east being cool. And with that, we're expecting quite a really active southern storm track. And when there's an active southern storm track, yeah, it's snowy and it's cold to our south. it does not mean that we won't get a lot of snow this winter. In fact, I think we're going to have a pretty active winter in terms of that. But I think on average, when we put all together at the end of February, we'll look back and see that winter will be slightly drier than average. But you can have a lot of snow and still be dry.
And finally, tell me a little bit about South America, please.
Yeah, well, I have a good friend in South America right now, and he is touring around parts of Argentina. And with all of the incredibly heavy rain that they had in November, they have dried out to start off the month of December. He actually sent me a video of a dust devil near Santa Fe, which is some of the most productive area. So while Argentina has not had the most ideal conditions for the start of their growing season, Brazil has been the opposite of that. They've had a great start. And while we do see it drying out of most of Brazil's growing regions over the next 15 days or so, we also see the return of the strength of the monsoon coming in by the time we get to mid-month or a little bit beyond mid-month, suggesting that this drying out will likely be a temporary feature. But it's still something to be watching. And of course, you know, things can change. So Brazil got in early and it's having a great start, but we'll have to be watching them January especially to see how things evolve.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
That, of course, is Eric Snodgrass. He is with Agrible.